What's happening, Catskill? You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. This is Chuck Ansbacher, Broody Duck, signing off.
Brooklyn Vegan runs down the lineup for the 2023 edition of 24-Hour Drone, set for May 27th through 28th at Basilica Hudson in Hudson. The annual event has been on hold in person since 2019 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. This year, the show is back in person with Yuka C. Honda of Cybone Matto, Wolf Eyes, Liturgy, Sarah Hines, Laura Ortman, and others performing at the event, which each year is webcast at WGXC.org and broadcast on 90.7 FM. The Basilica Hudson website has all the details about the 24-hour drone show May 27th and 28th at Basilica Hudson and will air on WGXC.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at WGXC.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Melissa Alfdermar and Tony Stone of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Wednesday, May 10th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Joshua Solomon reports in the Times Union that on May 9th, Governor Kathy Hochul declared a state of emergency due to, quote, the arrival of increased numbers of migrants seeking shelter, unquote, in New York City. The mayor there, Eric Adams, is planning to send asylum seekers to a handful of upstate communities. Hochul's declaration will let state and local officials distribute $1 billion from the recently enacted state budget to help house those migrants. Hochul said it is, quote, already a large-scale humanitarian crisis, unquote. A rule enacted by former President Donald Trump to keep migrants out of the country is set to expire soon, leading to many states taking similar actions. Right now, New York City is temporarily housing nearly 37,000 immigrants from the U.S.-Mexico border, including roughly 1,500 in the past week. Hochul's declaration said this is, quote, a disaster emergency to which local governments are unable to adequately respond, creating a threat to health and safety, which could result in the loss of life or property, unquote. Most counties in New York already have an affordable housing crisis, so adding new people looking for shelter will just make that worse. Rensselaer County Executive Stephen McLaughlin declared his own state of emergency just before Hochul's announcement, but instead of providing funds for the crisis, it declares that no hotel or municipality can enter into a contract to house migrants. McLaughlin tweeted, quote, pick a different city picture other than Troy for your illegal invasion advertising, unquote. That prompted a response from the New York City Mayor's Communications Director, Maxwell Young, saying, quote, bigotry, idiocy, and legal ignorance all in one tweet, unquote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Hudson Mayor Kamal Johnson posted on social media on May 8th that Hudson Police Chief Ed Moore will leave office May 19th with a walking out ceremony at noon. Johnson wrote, quote, "I want to thank him for his service over the past decade. Through periods of turmoil and a global pandemic, he's led our force. As we look to a new era, I'm proud to announce that lifelong Hudson resident Lieutenant Mishanda Franklin will be stepping into the role of chief. I'm proud to announce that the future of the department is in great and capable hands. She will be the city's first woman of color to accept this position," unquote. Franklin's swearing-in ceremony will be at 9 a.m. on May 22nd. Jamal Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that Austerlitz is celebrating what would have been world-renowned artist Ellsworth Kelly's 100th birthday this year with an event at 11 a.m. May 20th. The American painter, sculptor, and printmaker was based in Spencertown and would have turned 100 on May 31st, 2023. Quote, "Ellsworth Kelly brought his art to the community and his philanthropic endeavors that support students, not just in Austerlitz, but the Chatham School District and beyond," unquote, said Carrie Allen Barato, a marketing and communications specialist at Berkshire United Way, a former writer at Bard College at Simon's Rock, and a former editor of the Chatham Courier. Quote, "He was internal to Chatham. His studio was on Main Street in Chatham for a long time. I think it was nice to have such a big artist have a home and work out of a small town in Columbia County," unquote. He was born in Newburgh, and officials are dedicating the Austerlitz Town Hall to him this month. Austerlitz Town Supervisor Robert Lagonia said, quote, "This dedication shows how much the town and beyond loved Kelly. His dedication and philanthropic endeavors have been tremendous for the community. I can't say enough positive things about what the Ellsworth Kelly Foundation and Jack Shear have done for the community. It's been incredible. They helped fund broadband for those who need it in the community, and they helped fund a new town park. I have nothing but the utmost respect and admiration for both the Ellsworth Kelly Foundation and Jack Shear. It's an amazing thing they did for us," unquote. To celebrate his centennial, there are also exhibitions and installations of his work at the Art Institute of Chicago, the Glenstone Museum in Potomac, Maryland, and the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Wednesday, May 10th. Local early morning temperatures range from a scary 30 degrees in Stephentown to 38 in Tannersville. Regional average soil temperature is 51 degrees. Another sunny spring day today, high of 73 at 4 p.m. Overnight, shouldn't be quite as cold, hitting 46 degrees. Tomorrow, a high of 80 happens at 3 p.m. A dip to 52 degrees overnight takes us into a warm Friday, high of 83. Saturday, chance of rain all day, high of 79. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 1:03 a.m., high tide at 6:59 a.m., low again at 2:04 p.m. and high again at 7:52 p.m. The river temperature will be 57 degrees and the tide strength will be average. Sunset today will be at 6:48 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 4:36 a.m. Looking way up, we see the atmosphere is ringing from a coronal mass impact early this morning. X-class flare chances are still at 20%, so don't be surprised if you see a GPS glitch or an extra dropped call today. Solar wind speed is 599 kilometers per second at 0.2 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently terrible till dark, then fair below 8 megahertz overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 5.3. Storm level. The current sunspot number is 151, and this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
You have the already global networks. So my argument is very simple. The present media is too large and wasteful. From now on, we should think about the more smaller media to diverse our culture and community. I have different idea on airwave. Airwave belong to the every people, everybody, not to the states or a government. Okay, I will make the transmitter now.
us the distant glow. Just for now, let's say it so.
From somewhere up in the Catskill Mountains, that is Two Dark Birds from their 2022 album Porous. The song is called Two Stars on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM. We are tuning in the sounds of Wave Farm now through Zach Poff's Pond Station with hydrophones in the Wave Farm Pond. The test site for Acoustic Commons has a microphone in the woods at Wave Farm. We're also listening to Solar Radio. Quintron's Weather Warlock synthesizes the changes in precipitation, sunlight, wind, and temperature, turns it into sound. And Quintron's Traffic Sax monitors activity on Route 23. This is the Wave Farm Flora and Fauna Report about the animals and plants this week at Wave Farm. All that rain we got last week meant lots of growth. And the lawnmower had to come out this week because the grass grew so high. 3-4 inches of grass growth after all that rain. This week we're getting a little sun instead of rain. Although the weekend might be wet again, forecasters predict. But we're seeing lots of bird activity. The trees are all filling in. Mountaintop looks green up there. Seen not an abnormal number of rabbits, but probably the normal number of rabbits here this spring. But as you can hear, things are sounding nice out there.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Everybody in this meeting reiterated the positions they were at. I didn't see any new movement.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said following Tuesday's White House meeting with President Joe Biden, congressional leaders from both sides of the aisle were unwilling to compromise in debt limit negotiations. The meeting comes just over a week after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told lawmakers the U.S. will run out of tools to pay trillions of dollars in debt by June 1st. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said McCarthy still has not taken defaulting on the national debt off the table, which he called reckless, irresponsible, and extreme.
America must always pay our bills. A default would be catastrophic for everyday Americans, for small businesses, for people all across the land.
Congressional leaders are set to reconvene with President Biden again on Friday. A federal jury found former President Donald Trump sexually abused and defamed E. Jean Carroll, a writer who accused Trump of raping her in a dressing room in the mid-90s. Although Trump has been accused of sexual assault by more than two dozen women, Tuesday's verdict marks the first time he's faced legal consequences. Trump's attorney, Joe Tacopina, told CNN they're ready to proceed and go forward.
Strange verdict. This was a rape claim. It was a rape case all along, and the jury rejected that, but made other findings, so we'll obviously be appealing those other findings.
New York Representative George Santos has been criminally charged by federal prosecutors in New York. The exact nature of the charges are still unknown, but the Republican lawmaker accused of being dishonest about his background could appear in federal court as soon as this week. A Texas House committee advanced a measure Monday to raise the minimum age to buy semi-automatic rifles from 18 to 21. Two Republicans joined Democrats in an 8-5 committee vote. Before the House convened on Monday, advocates made their voices heard at the Texas Capitol. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has said he believes the measure to be unconstitutional. Finally, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed three bills into law Monday, which intend to mitigate the influence of the Chinese government in the Sunshine State. The measures will prohibit land ownership in Florida by Chinese citizens, ban the use of popular Chinese-owned social media platforms like TikTok and WeChat on government devices, and limit colleges and universities from building relationships with foreign countries of concern like China.
So today, Florida makes it very clear. We don't want the CCP in the Sunshine State. We want to maintain this as the free state of Florida, and that's exactly what these bills are doing.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our ATRUST indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We have another democracy lawsuit to watch, this time in Washington State. The case challenges the Washington Voting Rights Act, the state's response to portions of the Federal Voting Rights Act being struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. May 11th, the Washington Supreme Court hears oral arguments in Portugal versus Franklin County. The Brennan Center for Justice reports that many Washington counties use an at-large method of electing county commissioners instead of voting districts. In 2020, Latino voters sued Franklin County because its at-large system made it difficult for Hispanic candidates to get elected and represent their community's interests. One-third of eligible voters in the county are Hispanic and 54% of the population. The county settled and agreed to create voting districts. A county resident challenged the Washington State Voting Rights Act under the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. He claims the minority population isn't sufficiently concentrated to draw districts as the Federal Voting Rights Act prescribes, and therefore gives unfair treatment to minorities over other county voters. Voting rights groups worry that should the case reach the current anti-voter U.S. Supreme Court, it could further erode protections of minority voters in states like California, Oregon, New York, and Virginia, which adopted similar state voting rights protections. We'll keep you updated. We have links and groups taking action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
And we want to look into what's on the WGXC community calendar. So many events, virtual and in reality, choose from if you're looking for something to do. And as always, you can add your own event there at WGXC.org. Click on the community calendar and then click on add an event and just fill in the blanks. And soon enough, folks will be reading your events information on the radio and seeing it around the world in the community calendar at WGXC.org. Wednesday, May 10th, there's a screening of Sonita with the filmmaker Sonita Eliza Day at Star Cinemas, the Upstate Films in Rhinebeck. Story of a young Afghani refugee. And it is a musical film, as Upstate Films has recently boosted their sound system and has been focusing on some movies that have sound in the forefront. Thursday, May 11th, there is a Spring Movement and Music Storytime workshop with Abby Lappin at the Hudson Area Library at 4 p.m. At 6 p.m. at the library, there's something called the Spout Opening Reception, the Society to Promote Our Unique Town. The reception includes a talk, wine, cheese, whale cookies from Talbot and Arding. Hopefully not made from blubber, but... find out more in the WGXC community calendar. Also, Thursday, May 11th, if you're interested in doing radio, if you'd like to be on WGXC, then this is the event for you. Turn out at 6 p.m. at the Kinderhook Memorial Library on 18 Hudson Street, 6 p.m. Thursday, May 11th. If you've got an idea for a radio show, or especially segments we're looking for, because we're almost full of shows, but we're looking to put people on in the primetime hours when most people are listening to the radio. That's before and after Democracy Now! In the morning, and from 4 to 7 p.m. in the evening. It's called drive time, when people are getting in and out of their cars, maybe only listening for a short period of time as they're driving. And so that's perfect for your segment about reviewing local restaurants, talking to local farmers about agriculture, maybe touring local thrift stores, talking to new business owners about their triumphs and tragedies. Maybe you want to go talk to some local seniors about their stories. Whatever your idea, think of the Better Weather on WGXC, one of our most popular segments. It's only 2 or 3 minutes long. These segments could be up to 10 minutes. We've also got segments on from the Master Gardeners of Columbia Green Cornell Cooperative Extension. So those are some examples of segments you might do. So turn out to the public info session Thursday, May 11th at the Kinderhook Memorial Library. There's also a second session, if you missed that one, Saturday, May 13th at the Catskill Public Library. That's at 10 a.m. on Saturday. Same story. Meredith Cooey is running the Community Contributors Program at WGXC, and she'll be there to tell you all about it. Other local events this week in the WGXC community calendar. Upstate Films in Rhinebeck is showing The Crucible on Thursday. That's at 7 p.m. There's a community spaghetti dinner at the American Legion in Greenville at 4:30 p.m. on Friday, May 12th. MPAC in Troy is got something called Outside In with Mark Lowies and Rafaela Thiret. It's inspired by the logic of the Panopticon, prison designed by architect Jeremy Bentham in the 17th century that sees all. Then on Saturday, yes, we did mention that public information session. If you want to become a WGXC community contributor, turn out to the Catskill Public Library Saturday, May 13th at 10 a.m. Find out how you can be on the radio on your creative community radio station. Also Saturday, May 13th, the American Kennel Club Scent Trials is on at the Museum of Firefighting in Hudson. That's at 10:30 a.m. The Albany Obedience Club is hosting it. Saturday, May 13th, there's a Drag Queen Storytime in Wonderland with Ella Gent. That's at noon at the Hudson Area Library. The Phoenix Web Collective in Hunter is hosting a mosaic workshop Saturday, May 13th at 1 p.m. Artist Julie Scott is leading that workshop. The Orpheum Theater in Saugerties is showing a documentary about the Midnight Cowboy movie, 5 p.m. Saturday, May 13th. Saturday, May 13th at the Spotty Dog Books and Ale, author Norman Douglas, who is a programmer on the station, debuts his literary collection Love and the Fear of Love. That's at 7 p.m. at Spotty Dog Books and Ale with local poet Karen Schomer and regional author Andrew Amalix. Sunday, May 14th, the traditional Irish music sessions at 2 p.m. at the Shamrock House in East Durham. And these are just some of the events on the WGXC community calendar. Find out more by going to wgxc.org and clicking on the community calendar.
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
It'd be about
chocolate pigs.
She's obsessed with pigs.
Chocolate pigs.
Awesome.
All the way down.
That only dogs can hear.
Burn his.
I turned it down. Do it.
Did you hear that?
No.
On Thursday, May 11th, turn out for a public information session for WGXC Community Contributors Program. If you want to be on the radio at WGXC, now is your chance. Turn out at 6 p.m. Thursday, May 11th at the Kinderhook Memorial Library for an information session and a chance to find out how to get on the air at 90.7 FM. The WGXC Community Contributors Program is created to bolster Wave Farm's mission of participatory radio. We're looking for volunteer producers, programmers, and more to make segments to air in the primetime drive time hours on the station. It features reviews, stories, and more. If you'd like to interview local farmers or do restaurant reviews or have another idea for a short segment on the radio, please get in touch at content@wgxc.org or turn out May 11th at 6 p.m. at Kinderhook Memorial Library for a public information session about the WGXC Community Contributors Program.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're joined by Blair Horner, Executive Director of NYPIRG, New York Public Interest Research Group. And finally, after a month past April 1st deadline, we have seen a state budget adopted in New York State. Blair, what are some of your observations with respect to the good and the bad and I guess the ugly in the state budget?
Well, in terms of the good issues, and thanks for having me on, I mean, we were happy to see that the governor and the legislature came to an agreement on saying that later this decade, all new building construction in New York would have to be powered by electricity, not fossil fuels. And while the deadlines should have been shorter, New York is the first state in the country to do that. And we think that's the inevitable step that society has to take to get off fossil fuels. And so we were happy that that happened, although it could have been better, of course. On the issue of looking at higher education, state university and city university college students, the governor's proposed tuition hike was rejected and her cuts to financial aid were rejected and restored. So that was a sort of a good part. On the bad part, were things that were left out of the budget, one of which that we worked hard on was to create a program that would tag the oil companies for the cost of climate damages in New York. The Senate had it in its one house budget proposal, but the opposition by Governor Hochul kicked it out of the budget. And then I would say the ugly part is the fact that the budget was a full month late, and it was largely due to the governor insisting on policy changes that really were tangentially at best connected to the budget. And that sort of slowed down the whole budget parade.
Now, this was, her first budget after getting elected, by her own. Previously, been, elevated to governor after Governor Cuomo departed over the sexual harassment charges levied against him. It kind of seemed like she didn't have a lot of the respect from the legislature. She early on lost the appointment to the Court of Appeals. Where does her power sort of stand with respect to a traditional governor as we move forward?
Well, I mean, this governor is the first governor since Eliot Spitzer got elected in 2006, who didn't win with a sizable popular vote. Even when Cuomo ran for his third term, he was still winning with well over 55% of the vote. And so I think the fact that Governor Hochul squeaked by a fairly conservative Republican in New York, a blue state, I think diminished her political clout within the Capitol. And she's facing, in fairness to her, Democratic supermajorities in both houses. And I think they're looking to flex their muscle to be treated as a co-equal partner in government as compared to a junior partner, which is the way they've been treated for the past 10 years or so. So I think part of it is that, part of it is a sort of a political perspective by lawmakers that she's not as a political giant. And the other part of it is, I think, in the pull and push of how Albany operates, that the legislative branch wants to reassert itself.
Now, one of the issues that Nyberg is known for is a good government advocate. And, earlier we had talked about the issue of whether or not the legislature, particularly assembly, would put the money on the table needed to implement the partial public campaign finance system for state legislative races. It was out, it was in. How did that end up, and were there other good government measures that either were in the budget or is still alive?
Well, the budget, the governor proposed $25 million for the to go toward the sort of the public match. Governor Cuomo and state lawmakers created a voluntary system of public financing so that candidates could run for office and rely more on clean public resources than special interest money. And so that the governor put in $25 million. You're right. There was a lot of noise coming out of the legislative branch that they didn't want to do it. But ultimately they did, and added $14.5 million for the administration of the program. So I think the program is off to a good start. We'll see if it's sufficient in terms of the elections in 2024, which will be the first ones where lawmakers have to run. I mean, what's different about this program from what we had called for is we had just urged lawmakers to agree to a New York City system, because that's been road tested for 30 years, and apply it to the state. And instead, they came up with something that's a lot more complicated. So we'll have to see how that works out on the administrative side and on whether or not candidates feel like they can pull it off in terms of complying with all of the requirements.
Now,
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mark, but in terms of other issues that are on the table, I mean, I think lawmakers are going to be looking at, there's a couple of issues, many issues, of course, but one of which is there was a lot of lobbying around the effort to get Hector LaSalle to be the chief judge in the Court of Appeals. Under New York state law, none of that advocacy was considered lobbying. And this legislation has been introduced in both houses. The Senate moved the bill to the floor, and the legislation has been introduced on the assembly side by a local Democrat, John McLaughlin, who chairs a relevant committee. So we're hoping that that loophole could get plugged. There's also a measure, the law that made it easier for people to get absentee ballots and to mail them in expired at the end of 22. And there's legislation in both houses to try to extend that permanently to try to deal with the problem that may exist as early as next month, where people are going to hope to get easy access to absentee ballots and won't be able to do that unless the law's changed.
Now, you had mentioned that, you know, some of the climate issues, you were pushing the climate, you know, Superfund Act. There was, I guess, some agreement around this concept of cap and trade. They call it cap and invest, carbon pricing, but they sort of just agreed if we do it, this is where the money goes into a dedicated fund. But seems to have sort of left all the details to the administration. So where do we move on carbon pricing? And does the climate super fund, you know, does that come back? I mean, because they've been talking, you know, somewhere in the $10 to $15 billion a year needed to, you know, fund this climate transition in terms of new state funding. The governor's been very vague as to what cap and invest is going to talk about. But, you know, one rumor is he's talking about maybe $3 billion a year, which is certainly shorter than the 10 to 15 that's needed.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that the, just for the listeners, is this cap and invest is that the state will cap, will set a cap on the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that would be allowed. And anyone who's polluting or pumping out greenhouse gas emissions would have to pay into a fund that the state then would invest in programs statewide. And the legislature was far more detailed in their agreement about how the money would be spent and largely left it up to the regulator, the Department of Environmental Conservation, to figure out how to come up with this, the actual program itself. Whether or not it raises enough money, who knows? Governor Hochul earlier in the budget cycle had in fact attacked her own proposal and said that it would lead to 62 cent a gallon gasoline price increase. They never dealt with that. So I don't know what's going on in terms of where that number came from or why everyone now seems to have amnesia that she said it. But I think the Climate Superfund fits into that, dovetails nicely into what the legislature approved in a cap and invest, because all of the major infrastructure projects, the new roads, the natural protection for sea level rise, the stronger bridges, all of those things are enormously expensive and they're not really contemplated to be the way that the cap and invest would spend its money. Cap and invest is supposed to be spending the money primarily on transforming to a green economy, but the infrastructure costs are going to be massive. There was a recent report that came out in Newsday about a month ago that estimated that Long Island alone would need $100 billion to deal with rising sea levels and more intense storms. There's one report put out by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that said to protect New York City Harbor alone would cost $52 billion. And so no one is talking about that. And at some point, you know, you can't keep whistling past that graveyard. People are going to have to pay the money. And it's going to be right now, what Governor Hochul seems to want is that taxpayers pay for it instead of the oil companies. We're pushing.
We only got 30 seconds left. One of NYPERG's longtime issue has been mass transit. How do we end up with that?
Well, I think the agreement, the budget agreement, pulls the MTA back from the financial brink this year. The long-term problems are still there, and it'll still be an ongoing issue.
Blair Horner, NYPERG, NYPERG.org, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We're joined by Raya Salter, who is the founder and, executive director of the Energy Justice Law and Policy Center. He was also a member of the Climate Action Council that drafted the scoping plan out of the new state climate law. And she recently published, a blog responding to what the governor is proposing and the legislature sort of gave some support to do a cap and invest program. So, Raya, could maybe just briefly educate people as to what is cap and invest and what are some of your concerns?
Yes, and thank you. Hi, yes, I'm Raya, also known as Climate Auntie, where you can find me on Instagram if you like. And yes, I'm happy to. Thank you so much for having me on. So, yes, this idea of cap and invest is really cap and the idea of cap and trade just by another name. And it's a market-based mechanism that is, in theory, designed to both reduce greenhouse gas emissions by capping emissions and charging a price for folks to pollute, essentially, that gets ratcheted down with the idea that you know, through this market-based trading, allowance trading system, that GHGs are reduced, and then use those funds to actually invest in the type of clean energy projects that we need. So that's the broad idea of cap and invest. It's something that they're doing in California. It's something that has also started in Washington State. And it's something that in a similar type of form, we do regionally in New York with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, also known as REGI. And it's something that came out of the Climate Action Council planning process at the end of the year in a sketch. And then we saw a lot of activity in the budget around it. And I do have a lot of concerns, because without focusing on really the goals of the CLCPA and actually shutting down fossil fuel and investing in frontline communities, I feel that something like cap and invest could be a distraction. We need more than just cap and invest.
Now, many environmental justice groups and other climate groups over the years have been fairly opposed to the whole concept of cap and trade, feeling that it often results in allowing pollution to continue. And those neighborhoods tend to be low income and communities of color. I know that groups like New York Renews put out a number of suggestions as to some steps that the governor and legislature could take in order to try to potentially reduce the harm to EJ communities moving forward. But that didn't seem to get enacted. Do we have any sense what the legislature or the governor may be willing to do along some of the concerns that groups like New York Renews articulated?
A lot of EJ groups have been historically, you know, against to cap and trade. And this is something I was very concerned about and also voiced at the Climate Action Council. We've seen in California and in REGI, there have been analyses that have shown two really important things. One, the idea of a market-based mechanism on its own, that a market-based mechanism on its own will get a will reduce overall greenhouse gas emissions at the trajectory that we need to meet our climate goals, is proving to be a problem. It's not happening in California. And we have every reason to believe that absent additional regulation, we won't be able to reach our goals with a market-based mechanism on its own. Second, we've also learned from California that the reductions that do happen don't happen equally. They don't happen in disadvantaged communities at the same rate as other places. We've also learned that from analysis of the REGI program. And that flouts what New York law says, which is we must take early action and prioritize emissions and co-pollutant reductions in disadvantaged communities. So we're concerned about program design, longstanding EJ concerns. Now, at the Climate Action Council, we talked about some of this, and at the council, really, we put together a sketch, a framework and guiding criteria of what a cap and invest program should look like. And I urge folks to return to that, because there's a lot that's talked about there in terms of how can we address EJ concerns? How can we mitigate them in the program design? For instance, having requirements that caps that are in or adjacent or impacted where EJ communities are in adjacent or impacted by these polluting sources, maybe you have a lower cap. Maybe that cap decelerates faster over time so we can accelerate the emissions reductions there. So there are ideas that were placed there that I hope get picked up and carried through that should be looked into in the rulemaking that comes from this. And I hope that the legislature follows.
Now, one of the steps that the legislature did do when they passed the CLCPA climate law was they created, I think it's called the Climate Justice Working Group, to make sure that the voices of EJ communities were heard. Mm-hmm. Since this appears like it's going to be done primarily through administrative regulation to DEC, has DEC indicated they're going to give a central role to the Climate Justice Working Group? And did the Climate Action Council, and mainly DEC, actually pay attention to the Climate Justice Working Group in developing the climate scoping document?
So that's a very good question. So yes, that in the climate action, in the climate scoping plan, and in their statements about the rulemaking that we are anticipating around cap and invest, there's consistently this language that we are going to engage all the stakeholders. We're going to engage environmental justice leaders and others in the design of this program. I think we're going to see a more straightforward kind of, rulemaking. I don't think we're going to see the Climate Action Council and the Climate Justice Working Group sort of re-stood up to specifically address this, or I doubt that, although that could be a positive thing. But what is really important about the Climate Justice Working Group is that they finalized their criteria for who is a quote-unquote disadvantaged community. And that was a multi-year process that was supported by the DEC, comment all around the state, that was finalized just like a month and a half ago. Why is this important? Because this is officially in New York law, helping decide what the invest part of cap and invest would and should look like. And I was disappointed to not see more of the, you know, how the New York State's climate justice mandates would apply to cap and invest in the governor's cap and invest proposal. But in any case, myself and others and the Climate Justice Working Group will be, and individual folks will be pushing really hard in this cap and invest rulemaking to make sure that we see strong benefits going to disadvantaged communities as is required by the CLCPA.
Now, about a month ago, the climate movement went into overdrive when the governor suddenly appeared to be backing away from some of the reductions in emissions, because when the state of Washington went to a cap and invest for the first time, their price at the auction was, I think, a little bit over $40 a ton, which is more than apparently Governor Hochul might have been anticipating, and began to raise concerns how it would increase prices at the pump. And yet at the same time, when Congress and others have looked at cap and trade, one of the reasons they tend to not to work too well is that the politicians end up making the cap not as tight as one would like because of pushback from the fossil fuel industry. So are we concerned what Governor Hochul is going to do, given that she really, you know, began to run away from the plate just a month ago?
Yep. We have every reason to be concerned, because really, in my view, what that effort was about was not about cost, about cap and invest, but it was about the fossil fuel industry's long held and openly held desire to slow down the CLCPA and to fearmonger about cost. We didn't get a substantive analysis from the governor about cost, which is why I'm glad none of that ended up happening in the budget. We need to take a good look at the numbers in this upcoming rulemaking. But that, to me, we have every reason to be concerned, because that was what happened there. The fossil fuel industry throughout the entire Climate Action Council process openly wanted to slow down the climate law by changing how we do the greenhouse gas emissions accounting and, you know, other ways to slow it down. And to me, that's what that was about, not about cost. And yes, the governor has signaled that she is going to continue to press this issue about changing the GHG accounting for our climate law, and we must be vigilant.
We've been talking with Raya Salter, the Energy Justice Law and Policy Center. In the last 20 seconds, if people want to basically find out more what you're doing and keep on top of this issue, get some websites or something they can take a look at.
Absolutely. Follow me, Raya Salter, on Twitter. Follow me, Climate Auntie, on Instagram, www.ejlpc.org. And thank you so much for having me and covering this important issue.
And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that house inventory is at an all-time low, according to local realtors, and sellers are continuing to get large asking prices. The New York State Association of Realtors reports that home sellers in New York got 98.8% of their list prices in the first quarter of 2023. Interest rates have been raised 10 times, but that has not seemed to cool the local housing market. Governor Kathy Hochul and many Hudson Valley officials say there is an affordable housing crisis. In Columbia County, home sales increased 13.7% in the first quarter of 2022. They fell 2.6% in Greene County during the same period. Realtor Claudia Zucker of Living Structures Realty in Cairo said, and I quote, "We are not seeing prices come down in Columbia or Greene because there is a dearth of listings and a lot of buyers," end quote. Deb Smith of Coldwell Banker Prime Properties in Greenville said, and I quote, "There is absolutely fewer homes available. I've been working with someone relocating from Pennsylvania. We are on our 33rd house. We put in offers on three houses but didn't get them because of multiple offers," end quote. Across the border in Massachusetts, things are no different, according to Dwayne A. Powell of William Pitt Sotheby's International Realty, a lending realtor in the Berkshires. Powell said, and I quote, "There is no inventory. We've got plenty of buyers, but no houses to sell them," end quote. And there is more bad news. In Columbia County, there has been an 850% increase in foreclosure filings from the first quarter of 2022 through the first quarter of 2023, according to Arlene Hackle, deputy director of the New York State Unified Court System. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Brendan J. Lyons reports in the Times Union that the U.S. Attorney's Office may have other, and I quote, "targets or subjects of the investigation," end quote, into election fraud allegations among Republicans in Rensselaer County. The U.S. Attorney's Office filed for a protective order that would bar the three Rensselaer County government officials indicted last week in the case from disclosing any information they received through pretrial discovery in their criminal cases with other potential, and I quote, "targets or suspects of the investigation," end quote. Richard W. Crist, James R. Gordon, and Leslie A. Wallace were indicted in the election fraud case that revolves around filing false absentee ballots. So far, U.S. District Judge May A. DiAgostino, who is assigned the case for trial, has not made a ruling on the Justice Department's request for pretrial discovery protective order. But at the indictment, U.S. Magistrate Judge Andrew T. Baxter said he was, and I quote, "very concerned about the prospect of witness tampering or coercion," end quote, but rejected the government's request to not share all information with the defendant. But he warned them that any misconduct could result in a change in their pretrial release. The trio were indicted for allegedly conspiring to use their official positions to violate the constitutional rights of subordinate county employees to intimidate them into requesting and filing absentee ballots. Crist is the county director of operations, Gordon is director of the county's Bureau of Central Services, and Wallace is an assistant for constituent relations in the office of County Executive Steve McLaughlin. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Ian Valden reports in the Columbia paper that a 145-year-old bell was last seen at the Malden Bridge Community Center on the evening of April 24th and was reported missing on the morning of April 25th. The bell was originally cast for the old Chatham Methodist Church in 1878. The flyer being circulated in Columbia County says, and I quote, "Neighbors, friends, members of the community center, and members of the church congregations were shocked and heartbroken to see that the old Chatham bell had been stolen," end quote. Sheriff's Office Lieutenant Mark Dunsbaugh said, and I quote, "It's definitely a possibility," end quote, that the bronze bell made of copper and tin was stolen for its precious metal components. But Dunsbaugh said the perpetrators did leave some evidence behind. Lucinda Buckley, president of the Malden Bridge Community Center, said, and I quote, "It was in the heart of the hamlet for 50 years, and all of a sudden it's gone. It was part of our lives. It is a reminder that things don't always stay put," end quote. Read the full story in the Columbia paper. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, town meetings, a community calendar, and COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow. And now here is your WGXC weather update. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Wednesday, it will be sunny with a high near 73 degrees. Wednesday night, mostly clear with a temperature low of around 45 degrees. And on Thursday, sunny with a high near 80 degrees. And Thursday night, partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 52 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, in Green and Columbia County. WGXC has a new call-in number for anyone to leave a three-minute message that we will play back on the air. Listeners can leave as many three-minute audio letters to the editor at 518-212-7509 as they want, and WGXE will let your voice be heard on the local airwaves. The number again to call in and record a three-minute message that will be played back on 90.7 FM is 518-212-7509.
You can go there with your family. And you can meet new friends in the library. When you're at the library, you can read lots of books, and you can find any book. There are lots of Dog Man books, which are my favorite books of all. When I go to the library, I read them, and that's why I like the library.
I'm also on a radio show at the library, and there was also a video-making workshop that I did. And I did some animation, and I made a lot of new friends, and I laughed a lot, and it was really fun. My main reason of coming here is because it's books. Of course, it's a library. And I really like the wide selection of books, and they have computers and all sorts of stuff. They also recently did a mural painting thing where they painted the computer room in the back, and I got to be a part of that, and it was really fun. It looks really cool now. And I just really appreciate the library for being here. And if I had to choose between this library and any other one to go to, I would choose this one. I really like the Hudson Area Library, and I hope that it stays running for as long as I live or maybe even longer, because I know a bunch of people that love to read.